Pope Francis faces many challenges running the Catholic Church, but one of the most daunting may be his effort to reform the Vatican Bank, a powerful, entrenched, and secretive institution with a long history of corruption. In God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican, Gerald Posner exposes the many shenanigans and scandals entangled with the balance sheets of the world's most powerful religious institution. It's a story that involves embezzlement, fraud, high-profile investigations, murders, the CIA, gay prostitutes, and even Nazi gold. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased it has brought Gerald Posner back to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
You write that money has been a dominant theme in the history of the Catholic Church and that it often shapes the Church's divine mission. In what ways?
Some people might be surprised to hear that because they think of the Church is only about religion, but of course money has fueled it for so many times. It was money and power in the early days because popes were in fact pope kings. So when they had their own empire, it was fantastic. They levied taxes and they had enough money to fuel a lavish court. After they lost their empire, money became a bigger concern to them because they did not want to embrace capitalism. They thought loaning money and charging interest for it was usury. They had to somehow come up with an idea of how to bring in enough money to make sure they could live the lifestyle they were accustomed to.
Originally, indulgences.
That fabulous idea that Martin Luther didn't like so much, the idea of selling a piece of paper to somebody who was faithful and say you get forgiveness for your sins. And then, of course, Peter's Pence, which was the Pope is a prisoner inside the Vatican because we've lost all of Italy and the Papal States. Send him some money to help him out. And that brought in a pretty good amount until finally they had to reluctantly, kicking and screaming, come in to embrace capitalism slowly and then over time fully.
So they had to get past the feeling that lending money at interest was something that was a sin.
Exactly. And it was not as though there's a single moment that I can say, oh, this is the light switch. It flipped. Because you can see, as I described it in the book, there are a series of popes from Pius X to the 11th, Leo XIII. They struggle with this. And then they say, okay, let's do a little bit of lending. And then they give out an encyclical that condemns it at all costs. They were afraid of capitalism in some ways because they thought that capitalism encouraged modern thinking, free thinking. That was terrible because it would encourage people to have their own minds.
These days, Pope Francis has upset some Catholic conservatives by being critical of the current state of capitalism.
Absolutely. Francis will say, why when a homeless person dies on the street, it's not news, but if the stock market goes down 200 points, it is. He has the old Jesuit philosophy. He does, in fact, speak out for the poor. But his predecessors spoke out against capitalism because they thought it was the province of Jews and Protestants. It wasn't right for Catholics to be involved in some an unseemly business.
Jews got into banking in the Catholic countries because Catholics couldn't get into banking. It was a sin, although there were exceptions. The Giotto Scrivini Chapel, if I remember my art history, these people would try to pay for their sins as bankers by having the greatest artists of the time do a chapel for them.
You remember your art history very well. And as a matter of fact, it was only after the French Revolution, 1789, when the walls of the ghetto started to fall, and in Frankfurt they fell, and Meyer Amschel Rothschild walked out with his five sons, and a generation later the Rothschilds were the biggest investment bank in all of Europe, and the Pope had to go to the Rothschilds to ask for a loan. So did the subsequent Pope, much to the chagrin of the cardinals who thought it was
humiliating. He bailed them out twice.
There were cardinals inside who thought that it was humiliating to go to quote-unquote Christ killers for saving the church.
On the other hand, the Rothschilds probably thought that the Catholic Church was too big to fail.
They also thought it was the most disorganized. You're absolutely right. They thought it was also the most disorganized place they ever saw. And they asked the Pope for some favors, including taking down the walls around the ghetto in Rome, which he did. And after they repaid the Rothschilds, they put the walls back up.
When did the Vatican start creating something akin to a bank?
The middle of World War II. In 1942, in June of that year, they never had a bank before. They used to rely on our correspondent banks to do their business. They had gold, physical gold, some of which they moved to America at the start of the war. And in the middle of the war, they had a financial wizard inside the Vatican, a layman, who would come in from outside. He encouraged the Pope to start a bank in which there was one shareholder, the Pope. It had no obligation to turn a profit. All of its records were secret. And what it allowed them to do was take all of the business they were doing and move it dark so no one could keep track of it. And they kept business with the Allies while they kept business with the Germans.
And we'll get into that man who created the bank in a moment. But I'm wondering about the nature of the bank. How does the modern Vatican Bank compare to a Wall Street institution in size and power?
It's about the size, $10 to $14 billion can pass through it sometimes in a year. We're just learning about that because it was secret for so long. Let's say it's the size of a mid-size investment bank in the U.S. Not enormous. J.P. Morgan or Citibank would not even give it a thought as a competitor, but it's large enough to cause mischief.
But it's not as aggressive as a Goldman Sachs?
Well, it's more aggressive in some ways in terms of mismanagement. I mean, they were involved in business with, you know, the Titans of Italy, one of whom ended up dead underneath a London Bridge for murder and one who took cyanide in a jail cell. So, you know, Goldman Sachs certainly has a rogue trader occasionally, but never was sort of in league, at least as far as we know, with the types of scoundrels that the Vatican Bank was.
Does the Vatican Bank have ATMs these days?
They do, in fact.
Individual deposits?
They do have ATMs. You can use them only if you have a bank account there. It's used primarily by priests, but they don't give loans out. They've never given loans, so it's an unusual bank in that sense.
My guest is Gerald Posner, who is an attorney and has written about economic matters. His most recent book is God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican, published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So let's talk about Roberto Calvi, whose body was found hanging from a Thames River bridge in London in 1982. Who was he, and what was his relation to the Vatican Bank?
So Calvi was one of the largest, most significant bankers in all of Italy at the time his body was found in 82. He was actually on the run from criminal charges, a conviction in Italy. He had changed, got a fake passport. He was in London. They found his body underneath the Blackfriars Bridge, and the British concluded it was a suicide. Turns out 25 years later, after multiple investigations and new forensics examinations, it was concluded it was a murder. And why is he important? He was one of the chief people involved with the Vatican Bank in hundreds of millions of dollars of these what we call back-to-back loans, fake loans, to build up offshore companies to make them look as though they're valuable. And when the collapse took place, the Vatican Bank had to pay $250 million as moral consideration to the victims. And the archbishop who ran the Vatican Bank was indicted by the Italians, but the Vatican never turned him over because they said, "We're a sovereign country. We have no extradition treaty with you."
Now, what are the theories surrounding his death, and has anybody ever been charged?
In 2000, and finally, as 2005, 6, and 7 came along, Italian prosecutors brought a case against five men, including a man who'd been with Calvi in London at the time in 82, two mafia figures claiming that it had been over a complicated money laundering that Calvi had been doing, in part some of it to the Vatican Bank. All five of those men were acquitted. No one's ever spent a day in jail over Calvi's death. Another major financier in the Italian world was Michele Sindona. Some Americans may remember that name because he bought Franklin National here in the U.S. It was the largest failure of a bank in U.S. history at that time. $2 billion has since been eclipsed many times over. But Sindona ended up convicted of fraud charges and a murder of a prosecutor back in Italy. He was a partner with the Vatican. He had been personally selected by Pope Paul VI. He died in a prison cell with a cyanide capsule. It's been written off, or it's been concluded by the Italian prosecutors as suicide.
I get the feeling that for much of its history, the Catholic Church didn't keep track of the money that was coming in and out of the bank. Has it cleaned up its act? Are they doing keeping balance sheets these days and doing audits?
They are doing audits. They are doing balance sheets. And I think that they also did pay attention to the money that was coming into the bank, but they didn't keep an auditor balance sheet that anybody could examine as an auditor. Here's why I say that. After the war in World War II, they used the Vatican Bank to help fund the election effort for the conservative Democrats so that in alliance with the CIA in 1948, that election with Cardinal Spellman sending congressmen over to Rome and with Pius XII forming an alliance with Truman and with Churchill, they pushed for those conservative Democrats to get elected. When the Polish Pope, John Paul II, was elected in 1978, 5 months later, Margaret Thatcher became the Prime Minister of England, and Ronald Reagan 2 years later, they formed an alliance to use the Vatican Bank to send millions, literally, back to solidarity and the resistance movement against the communists. So they have had those men who run the Vatican Bank. They have an idea of where that money is, but they use it not necessarily for nefarious purposes, but for political purposes and power purposes.
Although you do outline some nefarious things as well. to this day, aren't there questions about whether the bank is compliant with modern banking practices? Is it compliant with all of the EU's banking regulations?
Not yet. It's hoping to get on something called the whitelist, which means that it complies with all of the laws against that stop the funding of terrorism and money laundering. It might surprise some people to find out the Vatican had no law against money laundering until 2010. So this is rather new to it. It's trying to get there. There's another evaluation taking place this year. I think they're sincere. I have no doubt that Francis is trying to reform this bank. The question is, at 78, will he be in office long enough to change the bureaucracy underneath him that is filled with traditionalists who don't want the change?
Now, you say that the bank has been used as a political tool. Doesn't that go back to its beginnings? One of the founders of the Vatican Church was a man named Bernardino Nogara, and you discovered evidence that he was a Nazi spy.
What evidence did you find? Okay, here's what I have, Leonard. I have a document from the National Archives that is an interrogation by none other than James Jesus Angleton, who went on to his own fame afterwards, of CIA fame, of a Carl Wilhelm Rehm, who was the head of Nazi Abwehr intelligence in Italy for recruiting, and he drew a chart for Angleton of what Nazi intelligence offices look like, and underneath one for Milan is the name Nogara. Now, what that gives is a very suggestive possibility that Nogara, who had been in Constantinople before he joined the Vatican, had run a network of informers and spies there for commercial purposes for a large bank. Was that Nogara on the Abwehr list? Here's the issue. I applied to get inside the Vatican files to see if the answer was there. They said no to me. They wouldn't let me in the secret archives. I believe the answer to whether Nogara, in fact, was working for German intelligence or whether he was in contact with them just to get information and use it for business purposes is hidden somewhere in Rome, but it just hasn't been released yet. Those Holocaust-era files are still sealed by the church.
But what if he's running the bank? Wouldn't that have been separate from what was going on in Germany?
Well, I think that what was important to Nogara didn't want the Germans to win. From everything I understand about Bernardino Nogara, who was truly a financial wizard, we use that word too often to say about somebody, but he was doing arbitrage before most people thought of it. He was very clever in his investments. He bought property in London and gold in America. He also had interest in Italian and German insurance companies, and those were the problematic ones because in Eastern Europe they were involved in all types of issues close to the Holocaust. The thing with Nogara, he wanted green profits. So he was invested on both sides because he didn't know who would win the war. Then when he saw where the war was going, by 1944 he started to cut all his German investments so that by the end of the war the Vatican could say, we were neutral the entire war, we were with you.
There was a scheme involving Jewish life insurance policies.
Yeah, the insurance companies like Generali, who was run by Nogara's best friend, Volpi, who had been the finance minister of Italy under Mussolini, they were starting to, and so did RAS, another Italian company, so did Allianz, a German company. They started to escheat life insurance policies. So you would have Jewish victims sent to Auschwitz who would die. And once they knew they were off to Auschwitz, during the end of the war, they started to take the full value of those life insurance policies off their books. They took the cash in. They knew they were never going to pay the amounts out. When the survivors showed up after the war and they said, my parents happened to die in a death camp, these life insurance companies said, show us a death certificate. We don't believe it. It wasn't until the 1990s when the World Jewish Congress and the Clinton administration finally got behind an effort for restitution that some families were provided some restitution. Who did not respond or collaborate or give a penny to the restitution? The Vatican.
There has been a debate over the years over whether or not many people in church leadership were sympathetic to the Nazis. Pope Pius seems to have had a mixed history, first looking the other way and then later condemning the Nazis. But Mussolini was also in cahoots with Hitler, so the Vatican had to be concerned about that. But why would the church even look the other way when the German Nazis were also imprisoning Catholics?
I think there were two things. One possibility is that they were afraid, no matter that they were imprisoning Catholics, if they moved against the Nazis or they spoke against it, there was some fear by the Pope they would move even harder against the church. And the other issue was they knew that 85 to 90% of the Nazi hierarchy were Catholics. They thought maybe, even though they revered the state, they might come back to Catholicism. What they feared more was Stalin and Bolshevism. They were absolutely petrified of the Reds because they knew that Stalin was closing down synagogues, Orthodox churches, Catholic churches. So they, even though they weren't crazy about the Nazis, they were less odious than the Bolsheviks, if that makes sense.
My guest is Gerald Posner, who is the author of 11 books, including a couple of New York Times bestsellers, one finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in History. His latest is God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Gerald Posner, whose latest book is God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. It is published by Simon & Schuster. A lot of gold looted from the victims of the Nazis was laundered through Switzerland. Haven't there been accusations that some of that gold also wound up coming through the Vatican Bank?
Yes, and there are two that I think need further investigation. The two that still have some credibility to me after looking into it is the gold that was looted from the National Bank of Croatia by the end of the Pavelic murder machine that escaped into a monastery
in
Rome.
That's the Ustasha.
Yes, government. Absolutely. The Ustasha had been the one of the bloodiest governments around, a bloodlust in Croatia in terms of Serbs killed and Jews. And the gold was looted there, brought into a monastery in Rome run by Draganovic, who was a priest who helped Croatians flee abroad. Some of that gold, a number of accounts say, got into the Vatican. The counterintelligence officer who was investigating it was told to stop his investigation by none other than James Jesus Angleton at a certain time. And the other question is Dr. Petracci, who had been the doctor for Pius XI, the previous pope of World War II. His son had made several $100 million at that time in brokering deals between the fascist government and others, had gold that they believe had ended up in the Vatican.
But a lot of this is conjecture, isn't it?
No question. I dismiss a number of stories that clearly are not true. So the question on these is, this: the trail ends with credible eyewitness reports of the money inside the Vatican and with counterintelligence reports from the National Archives that the investigators believe the money was in the Vatican. But what we don't have is the Vatican's files about this material at the time. They won't release them.
Do you think they ever will?
Yes, I think I hope so. I mean, I've what does it matter if I've called on it? It doesn't mean much, but I have sent a letter. I've called on Pope Francis. I understand he's reforming the bank going forward, but what about transparency toward the past? Maybe this man who believes in reform is a reformer who will open up the window a little bit for historians into the past.
There have been so many clouds over the Vatican. For example, it's also been accused of playing a role in helping prominent Nazis escape to South America. Through some kind of an underground railroad.
No question.
You would think that the church would want to clear these things up, either say, here's proof that it didn't happen, or yes, it did, but we are a very different church today.
Well, that makes perfect sense. But what the response was over a period of time, surrogates for Pius XII, who was the pope until 1958, what they did is the reports came about two priests, Father Weber, Adolf Eichmann, the head of the section that sent transports to Auschwitz, and also a Bishop Udall, who helped Stangl, who was the Commandant of Treblinka, escaped to South America. They drew a distance between the Pope and those priests. They said, oh, those were freelancers. Those were people who were helping all types of refugees after the war, and a few Nazis must have mingled in among them, and they didn't know that. Well, the record's clear now that those priests knew who they were helping, and I believe they did it with the blessing of the hierarchy inside Vatican City.
You mentioned earlier that in 1948, Italy nearly elected a communist government, and the Vatican kind of teamed up with the CIA to help prevent that from happening?
It scared the daylights out of Pius XII and the clergy in Rome that a communist government. As a matter of fact, the Pope had decided, and it's one of the things in the book that I talk about, Leonard, is the Pius XII had decided that if the communists won the election, he was going to declare himself a prisoner of the Vatican, as a predecessor had when they lost the Papal States to the Italian nationalists, and stay inside the Vatican until a conservative government was elected. But he did not have to do that in the end. It was a resounding, the largest victory in Italian history, the start of what would become nearly four and a half dozen governments over a period of time.
And you suggest that the relationship between the Vatican and U.S. intelligence continued throughout the Cold War with briefings by CIA Director William Casey and Pope John Paul II.
It was never closer than it was in the Reagan administration under John Paul II because of the fact they had a shared interest in bringing down communism in the East. But the thing that Reagan and the CIA liked is the Pope had something that we didn't. He had people on the ground, priests, in these little dioceses who could report back what was happening to their bishops. The bishops were reported back to Rome. Though it's the same way the Vatican found out early on what was happening in the Holocaust. The priests in Poland, in Croatia, in Romania, where the killing fields were, there were no Brits there. There was no British intelligence, American agents, American soldiers. Those priests reported back to the bishops what was happening in the field. They reported back to the Vatican. The Vatican had those reports of the Holocaust by 1940 of the Einsatzgruppen, the mobile killing squads, before anyone else.
Shouldn't we be pleased that the Vatican helped bring down these dictatorships? Well, but is the problem that the money that was being used still is rather shadowy? You talk about one incident involving $3.5 million in gold and an SUV.
Yeah, it is the first time I think this was disclosed, and that's $3.5 million in gold ingots put into the fake side panels of an SUV and a false bottom, and a priest drives it from Rome to Gdansk to fund Solidarity. Now, I don't think, look, if the Vatican wants to spend its money on a political issue that it thinks is important and it helps the overall cause of the religion, that's fine. And I don't think this history is all bad. Look, it's a history. It has some low points. There's no question about it. But in the end, it's like any history. If I did a history of the royal family in Britain or of Germany, there's going to be some sections in which you cringe at. And there's some cringeworthy moments in this history.
And we have some positive things. Pope Paul VI oversaw a revolution on how the Vatican managed its money. But then there's another major figure in this story, Monsignor Paul Marcinkus. Who was he?
He was the highest ranking American. He became an archbishop, was going to be a cardinal. He ran the Vatican Bank from 1970 through 1990, essentially for a 20-year period. He was there in the heyday. He was a well-intentioned cleric, 6'4" tall, looked more like the Pope's bodyguard. He did advance work for the popes. He saved the Pope one time when in Manila, a knife lunger to try to attack the Pope. But Marcinkus had no financial wherewithal, and he got involved with what I call the sharks, the Calvi we spoke about, the Sindonas of the world. And he became a director of a Bahamian directorship, an offshore company. He got involved in back-and-forth loans with these Italian companies that were fake fronts. And in the end, he almost made the Vatican bankrupt. He almost went to prison.
He was nearly indicted for the counterfeit security scheme, for a counterfeit security scheme. Was he ever reprimanded by the Vatican?
Well, he was reprimanded in the sense that he was never made a cardinal, never given a red hat, which everybody thought that he would automatically get. And when he resigned in 1990, he ended up retiring to Sun City, where he ran a small parish. I guess that's the equivalent of having been a three-star general. You don't get the fourth star, and you have to go home and run a small camp outside of Des Moines.
He once said, you can't run the church on Hail Marys.
He's absolutely right. He was a great pragmatist, and I do think that Pope Francis might not necessarily like that, but Marcinkus understood it was about dollars and cents in making a profit.
Should we think of the Vatican Bank as an offshore institution? Has it been used as a tax haven?
No question about it. As a matter of fact, maybe one of the greatest offshore institutions, because for those of you, and you've been, Leonard, you've been to the Vatican multiple times, many times.
Well, as a tourist.
Yeah, as a tourist, but you know that here's Vatican City, which is a country. There's no real wall. There's a wall of sorts, but there's nothing that stops you from crossing the street and you're suddenly in Rome. So when the Vatican Bank opened up in Vatican City, wealthy Italians said, oh, do you mean that if we deposit $1 million into a bank right across the street with a friendly cleric into that account, Italy won't know about it. The tax man won't know about it. No investigator will ever find it. And that's exactly what happened. Wealthy Italians, including mobsters, opened up accounts with priests who were family members or friends of friends, and they kept their money in the Vatican Bank, and they could get it anytime they wanted to because it was essentially like an offshore bank in the heart of Rome.
Is it true that it wasn't until 1987 that the Vatican started sending out rudimentary financial statements?
It's hard to imagine that that's true, but that's when the Pope actually ordered it, and that was done under the Polish Pope John Paul II. He started to send them out, and they were rudimentary, but they were better than nothing.
But this also is an invitation for money laundering.
Money laundering in the sense that this is what you asked me before. Are they compliant with what the Europeans want, with what the EU wants? And the reason why they are not compliant—
Or the Italian government.
Here's the issue. I think in many ways that I've come to appreciate, having worked on this book on and off for 9 years, since 2005, that the church is very much a reflection of its personality, which is Italian. I'm half Italian, so I can say this, and I'm not— And that means that in Italy, where we've had dozens of post-war governments, where we have often corruption schemes and problems in the government and nepotism, why should we think that just because these men have are clerics, that they're going to be different than the country from which they come? If this church had been founded in Germany 2,000 years ago, it would be a very different church. So it reflects that culture that is around it. And in that sense, I think that I'm not saying part of the problem is it's Italian, but it reflects the culture that next to it is so chaotic and has problems.
Yesterday, a guest said that one of the reasons Berlusconi remains popular is because people feel he'll be easier on them when it comes to tax laws.
Yeah, there's always he's the man with 18 lives instead of 9.
The Vatican Bank has had serious issues for decades. It's been under a cloud for decades. Did Pope Benedict make any effort to reform it?
Yes, he did. The reforms that Francis now putting into high gear, if he's putting them into sort of, you know, pressing the accelerator on the reforms, they started under Benedict. And the interesting thing is Benedict, if anything, was blamed for being unable to be a decisive pope. He really couldn't make up his mind, especially on the child abuse and pedophilia issues. He didn't seem to be strong enough. But on the Vatican Bank, behind the scenes, he's the one who started the process to open it up to European evaluators. But, Leonard, they had no choice, and that was because Italy gave up the lira. Once Italy gave up the lira, which was the official currency for the Vatican, they had to adopt the euro, and the Europeans said, oh, you're using the euro, we want to evaluate your bank. And Benedict said, I guess we have no choice.
There's always been political infighting within the Curia, but it seemed to reach a fever pitch under Benedict. And did that lead to the Vatileaks scandal?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I talk in the book about the fact that a group of insiders who really liked Benedict thought they were doing the best thing by getting away the person forcing out of office the person they viewed as the worst thing in his administration, and that was the Secretary of State, this Cardinal Bertone. They tried to orchestrate a leak campaign that would be embarrassing to Bertone. What they underestimated is the documents leaked have a life of their own, especially how the Italian press reports it. People reported it as though Benedict's administration was seething with dissent and was in chaos. It didn't really hit the Secretary of State as much as Benedict, and so it was misguided, unfortunately, and pressed the Pope as much as anyone.
You also deal with accusations that there is a, quote, gay network within the Vatican. Is there much evidence as that? There have been scandals involving gay prostitutes in the Vatican.
Yeah, you know, I did report that first. I just report about that. That's the Italian press was the first ones to report that. As a matter of fact, there was a what it called a gay lobby inside the Vatican.
And that came out with the Vatileaks.
The Vatileaks. And as a matter of fact, Pope Francis has said there is a gay lobby, but it's not such a terrible thing if you happen to be gay. The question was whether Benedict felt pressured by that, but we won't know unless Benedict tells us.
And is there a sense that that may have been one of the reasons he decided to resign?
It's clear that there's a number of factors that were hitting him at the same time, including not just that, but that the Vatican Bank was under investigation for money laundering, a number of areas. And I think that he more or less held up his hands and said, enough, there can be a better person in this seat of the Vicar of Christ.
Although there are many Catholic conservatives who don't think it's Pope Francis.
Absolutely. No, he's causing a torrent of uproar.
But he has high approval ratings at the moment.
Not among the conservative Catholics, but you're right. He's a populist. He's a great politician. And as most politicians who, you know, have higher approval ratings, he has it. And no matter what he says, people seem to like him.
And he has created a 5-person commission to conduct a top-to-bottom review of the Vatican Bank. Do you believe that it will push real reforms?
In the beginning, I was skeptical. I thought, oh, he's just saying it. Yeah, they have a commission for everything over in the Vatican, like most governments do at some point. Other popes have come in and said, I'm going to tame the Curia, and the Curia ran them over like a steamroller. But Francis has proven that he's serious about this. The only question is, he can't do it in a couple of years. He can't do it without changing the bureaucracy underneath. So he needs some time on this. You know, at 78, how long will he be pope? We don't know. So that question is an open one.
And we saw after Pope John died that the church started pulling surrounding the wagons again because it got more conservative for a while because people were kind of shocked by what John had done. It's likely the same sort of thing might happen after Francis is gone.
There's no doubt that there's an ever-diminishing number of Italian cardinals. They're smaller and smaller number because the popes keep appointing more cardinals from the Third World. But the Italians want the papacy back. They've been under Polish, domination now since 1978 until 2005, then Germans. Now they have an Argentine in. And although he has some Italian DNA, that's not enough for them. They wanted to return to an Italian pope, and there will be an effort for that in the next election.
You write that the Vatican always moved in tandem with the booms and busts of neighboring countries. How did the global financial crisis affect the fortunes of Vatican Bank?
This is one instance in which the Vatican Bank shined, and that was because they did not hold any securitized mortgages. They didn't have any of these wacky products that had been put out by American investment companies that later turned out to implode. They didn't have any unusual. They were rock solid in terms of what I call bread and butter investments, returning 2% and 3% a year, and they avoided the downturn.
When various dioceses in this country and in Ireland and elsewhere are fined because of the sex abuse scandals, does any of that money come from the Vatican Bank?
No, as a matter of fact, the Vatican, and I have one chapter about the pedophilia scandals, and what it focuses on is the money and the Vatican's efforts to insulate itself from any potential lawsuit. So what they were concerned about early on was, we don't want something that happens in Milwaukee or Pittsburgh or Tucson to eventually come back to the Vatican. So 11 dioceses have gone bankrupt here. They haven't affected each other. And when the Pope was sued, as he was by several American lawyers, eventually went to an appellate court and they held he was sovereign and could not be sued over the pedophilia scandals, there was a big sigh of relief in Rome.
Often when these things are discussed, people just say this is anti-Catholic propaganda.
Well, you know, I'm Catholic. I was raised by Sisters of Charity for 8 years. I went to Jesuits for 4 years. My mother was Italian Catholic and raised me in the faith. I was an altar boy. That doesn't mean that people will like, conservative Catholics may like what they see and hear, but this is a history. This is our history. This is a history as Catholics. And it ends on, it may be a grim book at some points, but it ends on a note of hope, because I do believe that Francis is trying to reform it so this history isn't repeated. That's the good news on this.
And what's the current status of the bank? Does it look like it's doing well these days?
It had lower profits last year. They had to take a charge against it, but it's going to survive. Francis had thought of eliminating the bank when he took office. He said, why do we need a bank? He asked the question many people asked, but he's been persuaded they need a bank. It's staying in effect.
Gerald Posner's book is God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. It is published by Simon & Schuster. And thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you so much for having me again.